ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 20 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Jimmy Unwellers of Vesta Bloodstock. Joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke and our special guest, Emma Friedman. Emma is an inspiring woman, both inside and outside of the media world, who's done it all from working on air on some of the biggest networks in Australia to becoming a mother and showing Australia how it's done on the ballroom on Dancing with the Stars. Emma, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Thanks so much, guys. I love that. Yes, it's nearly 10 years ago I did that show, but people really loved it and I still hear about it to this day.
Well, we'll certainly be touching on that a little bit later we'll kick off on your early days a little bit. Growing up on the Mornington Peninsula, no doubt a life full of horses. Were you a mad horse girl growing up?
I actually really wasn't, Justin, to be honest. I loved horses and I loved the business and I loved racing, but I, to be fair, had a fear of riding, and it's a fear I still carry a little bit to this day. I did ride a bit as a kid. We had a couple of ponies, did some pony camps, and my mum, who was an amazing dressage rider and show jumper, she was very keen on me learning to ride, as was dad. Not dad, probably not so much, but I think I must have had a couple of falls when I was really young, and it scarred me. So it's something that I would like to get back into when both of my children are in school, is properly riding, and whether it be doing something with OTTs, or it's something that I have in my mind I would like to do in the next couple of years. But in terms of the animal and the business and racing itself, yes, I was mad on it from a very young age.
It's sort of in the blood, isn't it? It's one of those things you don't really get a choice.
And I worked at the office with my family from a very young age as well. I remember when I'm 10 or 12 years old, doing voice, typing up voice reports or helping with accounts or mixing feed and stuff like that. So, yeah, I was definitely in there from a young age and trying to learn. Well, I'm guessing all the boys wanted the kids to learn the different aspects of the business and how the business operated.
For sure. A big part of your career obviously was with the stable, but it has been in the media, and including racing the media. What sort of inspired you to pursue this career path, and how did you get involved in the media space?
Yeah, so I always wanted to do something in communications. I did a degree in communications, and my best subjects at school were English and literature. So I had a knack for writing, a knack for talking, and I think when you're sitting at school and you're going, what do I want to do with my life? I love sport, I love racing, but I love broadcast, and whether that be TV or radio, how do I put it all together? I think I also looked at my dad, and he is such an impressive figure in the racing game, and he's achieved oh so much. I think it's very difficult for people who are the offspring of people like my dad to follow in their footsteps. I mean, I tilt my lid to, Ben, JD and Will. They've done an amazing job to follow in the footsteps very successfully of David. And Sophie's obviously very involved in their business as well. But I thought, well, my skills are in this area. That's where I'm probably best put to use. I have a great passion for sport and a great passion for racing. So I put them all together and came up with wanted to be involved with media, whether that be behind the scenes. And that's where I started. I was a producer on a number of radio shows while I was still doing my degree at university, and working behind the scenes at TVN as well, and then eventually in front of the camera. But I still have a great love for producing and production, and trying to get a broadcast together.
Obviously, you've had a great career in media, and it's been a really solid one so far, covering events such as Bathurst. You mentioned the cricket just before, but since 2021, the big part of your role has been on Channel 7's horse racing coverage, and that's given you the opportunity as well to work alongside someone such as Bruce McAvaney, one of the elite minds of just sport in general, and with yourself having covered at multiple sports as well. Does working with someone like Bruce help with your knowledge and, I guess, confidence on TV as well?
Oh, he's the most beautiful man. I'm very lucky that I get to work with him, but also some of our other superstars, whether they be behind the scenes or on air at Seven. you know, Caitlin McDonald is one of my best friends, as is Jason Richardson, as is Lizzie Jelf. So those three I work with week in, week out. Bruce comes in for carnival time and he's just the most magnificent human being. He's such a wonderful broadcaster, so well researched. He has his own ways of doing things, which are really unique. Some of the ways he does things I've never seen a broadcaster do before. So he has his own ways of doing things, but he makes anybody in his presence feel at ease. He's just got a beautiful soul. He's a very relaxed character. But anytime you are around Bruce, you feel instantly relaxed, which is unusual because sport and racing is a high-pressure situation and our broadcasts are high-pressure situations as well. You know, we're on air for 6 hours every Saturday. We don't get to throw to other venues for other venues to be covered by another team. We do, whether it be this Saturday. We were meant to do 3 meetings. We're doing 2 now. But, you know, during this summer period, we move into 3 meetings. So that's 3 meetings of form, 3 sets of trainers, jockeys, horses to get across, different tracks to get across, the stories that encapsulate those venues. It's a high pressure situation, but he's amazing. And you say 2021, well, yeah, it was a really pivotal moment in my career, but also that for racing broadcasting in a way. It's when we went to 52 weeks a year. So for racing to be on free to air 52 weeks a year is absolutely enormous. And I've been really happy to be along for the ride over the last few years.
Speaking of form, how much form are you having to do for a Saturday? Like, not only that, but you'd have to do the research on, like, all the racing participants and everyone you interview each weekend. I'm sure it's a lot of work.
Yeah, Taylor, it really depends on my role on the day, but I'm hosting, say, tomorrow, which means I have done a lot of form because we're doing mounting yards, we're doing chats about the stories of the week, about the participants involved. So when you're hosting, the form's really in depth, mainly because we're not only tipping, but we're doing the yards and you want to be across every single thing. Say on a really big day where my role evolves on a big group one day, say Everest Day, my role is more out in the field doing interviews, pre-race interviews with trainers and connections, and then post-race interviews with jockeys and trainers. My mindset does change. So the way I do my form alters to suit that. So I wouldn't be going through every single horse in each race that day going, okay, well, this horse is first up, probably needs a couple of runs. Oh, gear change on that horse. Oh, it doesn't like the wet. Like, I wouldn't be doing it like that. I'd be more, you know, some of that comes into it, especially for your pre-races. You need to know exactly where a horse is at in its preparation and if it's suited to the race that, and, you know, it's well placed in the race that it's running in. But storylines start going through my head. Okay, if this person won this race, what would that mean? If this horse was able to achieve that, what would that mean? So it does change. And I think that's something I've learned over the last few years. My approach to doing form changes depending on the role that I have on the day. But yeah, tomorrow, before Doomben was called off, I'd done form for 29 races tomorrow. 29 races. It's a lot. And it does take me a bit of time to get through, but you get better at it and you get quicker at it. And the more you do it, the more you know about the horses that you see. Like all the horses at Kembla tomorrow, you feel like you've seen them, you know, quite a bit, particularly over the last few months. It is a lot of prep work if we're doing that kind of meeting, a huge amount of work.
That's insane. And it's something that the average viewer on a Saturday probably doesn't realise, and they just think it all flows and you just do it off the bat. But it's a lot of preparation. It's pretty unreal. I guess for many years, you've been one of my personal idols, and I certainly look up to you as a woman who's accomplished so much and so many extraordinary things, not just in the media, but in your life in general. What words of encouragement would you give to the next generation of young girls aiming to build a career in any industry?
Oh, Taylor, that's very sweet of you. Thank you. Words of advice. I mean, I feel like I've been doing this a long time, but I'm still learning. And I think that's one of the key parts of being in a media role, whether it be, off screen or on screen, is like you always are learning. I'm learning every single day, whether it be perfecting the way that I do things on air, the way I do my form, the way I research. I think learning continually like is so incredibly important, because you never get to a destination, go, oh, I'm done, I'll just continue. And if you do, I think they're the people who tend to fall backwards in their careers. I have a little bit of a mantra that I live by in terms of particularly work, and I'd like to think all my workmates benefit from this. I'm a bit of a vibe bringer to a day, so I'll bounce in to a day and bring a really positive, energetic vibe. And I know anyone who's met me or even seen me, you know, doing what I do, they go, oh, she's, but that is naturally me. Like, I'm a very enthusiastic, positive person. So I like to bring that vibe to anywhere I'm working, because I think impacting the way that people feel, whether they are starting work or just being in their presence, has an impact on them as a person, but for their day as well. So I try and be the vibe bringer of the days. And yeah, it's just working hard, being nice and having fun. They're the three things that I kind of try to live by when it comes to work. The working hard, you've got to do your research. And there's no, I can't make it because of this. Like, you're there on time, you're there early, you're working hard, you're doing the research. Sometimes, like doing the form for that many meetings, it can get, you know, when it's big, big days, it's not hard at all. But when we're dipping back into, say, summer and winter racing, it can get a little bit more challenging. You just got to do it, right? Being nice, costs nothing to be nice and kind. And then having fun, because even though, you know, your podcast is called The Business of Bloodstock, it is a business, and it is a really serious business. There's a lot of money invested. There's a lot of people employed by the industry. You know, we have 6 hours of television to fill, but I truly believe you can have fun in anything that you're doing. And again, that impacts the product in a positive way. It impacts the people you work with in a positive way. But also then you go home at night and you're like, I had fun today. Like, it would be sad if you got home and you're like, oh, that was a shit day. And it was a big group one day and you saw whoever, you know, win a massive group one, and it was just an amazing story for them. Like, yeah, I get very invested in what I do. Yeah, that's probably to my detriment sometimes. I'm very invested in it, but I try and have as much fun as I possibly can whilst also working hard.
Well, that's the most important part about your work life, is that you enjoy it and that you make sure that everyone else around you is enjoying what they do as well. And that certainly comes across on TV. But one thing I will say as well is, no doubt that personality and that bubbliness that you bring to people around you as well would include your kids and your kids. You're a mother of two, and no doubt that's probably one of your biggest duties in life as well.
Yeah, my beautiful children and my beautiful husband as well. So home life is terrific. I actually, still at the moment, my kids are really young. My little girl only just turned 4, so, and neither of them are at school yet. My son starts school next year. But so I'm at home a lot with my kids and doing, you know, their activities a lot, whether it be tennis or swimming or ballet or Auskick. Like, I am their mum first and foremost. But, yeah, I think it's really important in this day and age that myself as a woman try to explain to my kids that working hard is really important. If you love what you do, that's an added bonus. But working hard is important, but also being at home for your family is important. I wouldn't say that if you work in racing, you have the perfect work-life balance. That's never going to be the case if you work in racing. But you try and make it work as best that you can. They see that I work hard. They see that I love what I do. They see me travel a bit, which sometimes isn't ideal, but it's part of the job. So, yeah, just teaching them that work's not a burden. I never felt like that in my family, that work was a burden for either of my parents. They were in charge of their own destinies and they worked really hard to achieve all the success that came to them. But I think sometimes we're all guilty of this, oh, I've got to go to work. I try and don't do that, because I go, oh, I'm going to work today. And they go, oh, have fun, you know, go and enjoy it. And yeah, so I think it's working as a woman in this millennium particularly, I think it's important to Yeah, educate the kids to mum's job's just as important as dad's job, even though mum's job probably is more fun, if I'm being honest, but my job's just as important as my husband's.
That's it. Would you like your kids to be involved in media racing in the future? I saw a video on socials the other day of your daughter Edie feeding Group 1 winning filly Manal. It looks like they have a pretty special bond too.
Yeah, she's a real performer, my little girl. She's quite like me. Very bubbly, funny personality. Like, you just look at her and you just laugh. Like, she's very amusing. I wouldn't be surprised if she follows in my footsteps or wants to do something similar to what I do for a job. In terms of the horses, they're both actually really mad for them. They love them. They haven't ridden yet. As I said, they're still very small. Something I would like to do in time. Will, my son, is very sporty. And he might follow with a path in racing, but I don't know. Look, they have the opportunity to. That's the thing. We're at Michael's yard at Randwick, you know, once a week, once a fortnight, just popping in, saying hi to the fam or saying hi to some of their favourite members of staff who work with Michael. They've got a real soft spot for Michael's racing manager, Sophie Johnson. So we're there all the time seeing Soph and a couple of the other guys who work at the yard. And, yeah, they've got no fear, which is good. They haven't – I should preface that, but I don't have a fear of horses. I have a fear of riding fast horses. That's my fear. I could – even though I'm little and light, I could never have been a jockey because I've just got too much fear of going fast. But they're always around it. So they will have the opportunity to do that if they want to. But as always, they will start at the bottom and work their way up to the top if they want.
You talk about your kids potentially wanting to follow in your footsteps or taking their own career path at the end of the day. It'll be their choice. But, for example, you growing up around Lee, it's pretty it's successful training environment that was. Was he a big part of helping your knowledge for horse racing grow and, I guess, the bloodstock side of things as well?
Yeah, probably the bloodstock side of things. I remember walking around with Dad from the age of probably 14, 15 at every major sale in Sydney, on the Gold Coast, and then in Melbourne as well. So I do remember walking around with him with a catalogue, and I still do it to this day because we'll, you know, say we're at the Magic Millions or, you know, the early sales of the year, I'll walk around with him and we'll talk about what we like in a horse. He'll continually educate me about what he likes physically in a horse. I don't think you can ever stop learning about that. Like, I like this, I like that. So I really listen to him on that side of things. And I think all people buying yearlings, that's a great asset to just walk around with different people, and people will tell you different things about why they like the physical of certain yearlings, and that's the beauty of it. It's an opinion. It's all so different, right? And that's why most lots at a sale will sell, because everyone's got different opinions. I like this, I like that. He was really great at teaching me about bloodlines and the history of bloodstock. We would often have discussions about that. In terms of racing, yes, in terms of how a stable operates and the role of everybody at a stable and the way that, I guess, every person in the industry cooperates and works together. In terms of programming, probably yes. I was often there moving things on whiteboards and writing, oh, this horse did, you know, evens today on Tuesday, fast work day, going to work, you know, 4 and 2, whatever it is. So, yes, it wasn't like a university course where you sit down, you're like, let's learn the world of racing and bloodstock. But I guess being around it so much, it's like osmosis, and you just pick up little bits and bobs, and he'll ask me, I'll do that, and you go, okay, well, better learn how to do it. I think my ability to read a race probably didn't come from him. That's something I've learnt later in life by watching a lot of, and I watch a lot of racing. Standing with my dad and watching a race, he'd only have eyes for one runner, and he'd often be cursing if it was parked three wide and with no cover. Like, he wasn't going to tell me, like, this is bad because. And so that's something I've learnt later in life. But again, we just all continue to learn about this great puzzle that is racing continually. If we all had the answers, we'd be squillionaires. So, not always learning.
Well, yeah, you mentioned there that it is something about always learning, and I'm a big advocate of that. You can never stop learning in this industry, whether it's horse racing, whether it's bloodstock, whether you're just trying to learn how to do form. And, you know, at the end of the day, you won't find a punter out there who's backed, you know, 20 out of 20 winners, and you won't find somebody who buys horses who's bought 10 out of 10 champions. It's sometimes a bit of luck, and it's a lot about self-education and just trying to learn as much on the way through as well.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's why it's an opinion game. That's why form, there are stats, obviously, within your form guides that can't lie. You know, this horse loves the heavy, this horse hates the dry, or, you know, this horse has only won over 1,600 metres, so don't expect him to perform first up over 1,000. But it's an opinion-based game, and trying to piece together the puzzle and giving weight, I guess, to things that you value, whether that be doing form or whether that be in inspecting yearlings, or whether that be doing what I do and going, okay, what do I value? What is of most value to my job on air? So it's an opinion-based game. I love talking to people about racing. Like, particularly in the last few years, some of my best friendships have really evolved through racing, because it's what I like to talk about, and it's what my friends like to talk about as well. So, yeah, I since doing the coverage full-time 3 years ago, I have found a renewed love for the game, and not that I ever lost love in it, but having kids and, you know, whatnot, working in different spheres of media, I probably wasn't as invested, but now I feel incredibly invested and focused on what we're doing right now and what the future entails too.
Now we will touch on Dancing with the Stars, and obviously you knew it was coming, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah, so you won the competition in 2015 with Arik. Could you tell us a bit about that experience and the amount of hours that required you to put in to get to the floor on a Sunday night?
Yeah, I loved it. So I did dance a lot as a kid. So that was my sport, so to speak, was dancing, but not ballroom dancing, which is a completely different caper. I'd never danced in a frame position with a bloke before in my life, which is markedly different to dancing on your own. It took a lot of training, and I loved the training. I love training hard for things. I still, to this day, you know, I exercise every day, and not like dance train, but I train every day. I run every day. I try and keep really, I value health a lot. So the training, it didn't bother me, because I really enjoyed the physical challenge of it and the mental challenge of it. It was hard. I found the hardest thing being like close to a guy who's not your partner. I found that like very confronting. And if you rewatch the tapes, I think you can see it in my eyes that's my fear. My fear is like touching someone that I am not involved with, like, as strange as that sounds. But it was a great thing to do. I loved the environment of working on the show, particularly on a weekend when we go in and we do the dress rehearsals, and, you know, we would camera block things, and you also learn about that. You know, as a media nuffy and a TV nuffy, that's a really interesting thing to learn as well. Okay, how many cameras? Okay, what angle? Where are the lights? Like, what lights are doing what? So the actual television side of things I really enjoyed. Maybe that contributed to why I enjoyed it oh so much, not just the physical dancing part of it, but that side of it, and then the team part of it. So there was, you know, 20 of us plus all the crew, and everyone just got along so well. We just had a lot of fun. So, yeah, it was a surprise to win it. They've popped up those videos a little bit over the last couple of years, probably courtesy of Seven. I was at a friend's house for a New Year's Eve a couple of years ago, and they came on at like 1 or 2 a.m. and I was mortified that they had dragged them up on YouTube. People who didn't know I'd done it going, is that you? But, yeah, that's me. Can we turn it off now? I don't know why I get embarrassed about it, because I am very proud of it as an achievement, more so that I you know, you work really hard. I don't care that I won it. I'm proud that I worked really hard and I got myself into like peak physical shape and learned so much. So, yeah, it was an awesome experience. I really, really enjoyed it. But yeah, can't believe it's nearly 10 years ago.
Yes, it was a long time ago, and I remember watching it as a little girl in the lounge. Oh, room, and
for you.
It was fantastic.
The only reality I do, I wouldn't do anything else. It's the only one I wanted to do because you actually have to learn a skill. You have to learn a skill. You have to work hard to learn a skill. So that's why I did it.
It was a great achievement to win it. We'll touch on the racing side of things now. We mentioned before about your dad, Lee. How was it being involved in a family that had so much success and so many champions go through the stable, so many memorable names that, you know, people remember from years ago still?
Yeah, obviously a blessed childhood. Started off living in a house at the back of Flemington with all of my uncles and aunties and mum and dad, and I think we had 28 boxes out the back. So, yeah, life from a very young age was pottering out the back of in the yard and mixing feed and carrying bits of gear to people who needed them and picking up poop and stuff like that. So that was from a really young age. Yeah, obviously it's, you know, you get very, I'm very proud of my father and my uncles as to everything that they've all achieved, and my cousins, in fact, over the last couple of years, very proud of everything that they've been able to do. It's a tough one because people go, oh, it must have been amazing, and it was, but it's also, I didn't know any different. That was my childhood, and my childhood was filled with horses and my parents working every single weekend, early mornings, a lot of owners in and out of the house, in and out of the yard. So, yeah, it's obviously a cool childhood to have a father who's a trainer. But, you know, he worked really hard. And even nowadays, like some of my friends who aren't in racing, they're like, oh, my God, but you work every Saturday. I don't know any different. I've worked every Saturday of my life. My father has worked every Saturday of his life. If you're in racing, like, that's just normal. And he, you know, there was obviously sacrifices as well. Like my dad, I reckon, dropped me to school maybe 10 times in my entire schooling, obviously because he was at work. When you get dropped to school, he would often pick us up, I think. But, you know, at early mornings, he was off doing, you know, track work. So, it's obviously a childhood filled with fond memories. Holidayed with a lot of great people in racing. I feel like all the people that we ever had over to the house or we went to people's houses were all in racing. So it was a very racing and breeding heavy childhood. And I'm still friends with a lot of the people who I hung out with in my childhood to this day.
Yeah, it's important to keep in touch with those you're close with younger as well and keep those ties. But I'll touch here, you were a very young girl in this period. Your dad had won 4 slippers in a row, and one of those horses was Flying Spur, and he's turned into what I see as an incredible broodmare sire anyway. And no doubt you're doing your form on a Saturday. You see a name like his mentioned quite frequently through your Saturday form. Is it a cool feeling to see, you know, that history that I guess you've grown up with still being seen as a heavy influence in today's racing?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, he's not one of mine, but he was one of Dad's. And any horse that Dad has trained, particularly to go on to a life at stud or even a mare that he's trained that's thrown great progeny, it does, you know, you might look and go, oh, remember that horse? But I think it would give my father a big thrill to see that kind of history still emanate through your form on a Saturday. I don't pay too much attention to it, I guess, because we all move on, and that you're right. I was those golden slippers, I was 6 or 8 years old, so it's a long, long time ago. I'm 36 now, so it's a really long time ago. But yeah, even when we were reflecting on the Cox Plate recently, and you know, we're talking about our favorite Cox Plates, and you know, I love reliving those memories from when I was in my late teens, because that's when I was allowed to start going to Group 1 race meetings when I was in year 12 and beyond. Before that, I wasn't really allowed to because it's workplace for Dad. So, like, what's he going to babysit you? Mum's got to deal with clients and stuff. So I didn't really go to – I went to more, you know, just benchmark Saturday meetings, but not the big Group 1 days. But being, you know, at the Valley, Maccabi Divas, Cox Plate, the wall of horses coming around the corner, like, when it's more when those – I guess big moments pop up and you see photos or vision, you go, wow, I do remember that. That's cool to have witnessed members of my family have a big hand in those moments being created. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's I didn't work integrally in the business at that stage. I was just my dad's daughter. But yeah, I am proud of everything that he and the boys achieved, and they continue to achieve. And I'm looking forward to heading up to the Gold Coast for Magic Millions and seeing the first progeny of Stay Inside, and obviously a Golden Slipper winner for Richard and Michael. That's really exciting stuff. So yeah, it continues to this day.
You mentioned that, so you'll be up on the Gold Coast in January, and obviously Stay Inside, I'm assuming, will be the first season side you're looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, and Home Affairs, I guess, as well. Looking through the catalogue last week, I couldn't believe the amount of yearlings by Home Affairs. I think he tops the catalogue in terms of raw numbers, which is just extraordinary for a first season sire. And they're all in book one, I think, which is even more incredible. So I obviously don't go around to the farms and look at the babies. That's not my job. It'd be a lovely thing to do, but it's not my job. So yeah, looking forward to seeing them on Complex. Home Affairs and Stay Inside, yeah, two first season sires that I'm most excited to see in the months ahead.
Do you at all, are you involved in any brood mares, or do you involve in any foals and try and send them through the sales at all? Is that part of what you do at all?
No, it's something I would love to do. Just hasn't eventuated yet. I think it's something I will do again when my kids are in school. Having kids in daycare is a very expensive thing. So once that cost has been reduced, maybe that cost will go into finding a mare and sending her to a stallion that I really like. So no, it's something I would like to do. Just haven't found means to do it yet. It's a very expensive thing to do. I think you have to pick up a mare online or at a broodmare sale, like that's an initially, you know, a massive investment, plus your stallion fee, plus all the cost on farm, plus presenting them for the sale. I think you've got to be in a pretty good spot to be able to do that, and maybe I'm not there yet.
You are involved in a lightly raced filly at the moment in Cindersea, by Deepfield, out of a great little mare, Ocean Embers. How's she going at the moment? And no doubt Black Type is the aim with a pedigree like that.
Oh, Taylor, don't mention the war. So she raced last weekend at Kembla, and she was a bit disappointing. And we were scratching our heads a bit, and Andy Adkins, who rode her, said, oh, I think it was the wind. Anyways, we got her x-ray. She had a bone chip in her knee. So she literally has just had surgery yesterday at Randwick's, at Randwick Vet Clinic, and had the bone chip removed. So she got out for a spell to get that all fixed. So she'll be fine, the poor little dear. And she's a beautiful little filly. And she is a little pocket rocket. And she, her winning her maiden first up at Newcastle last prep gave me such a big thrill. So she's really lightly raced, obviously. But yes, that one will have to wait. The game, isn't it? The game is just, and I've had a few opportunities like this where I've had, you know, particularly fillies, and they've gone amiss. So she will come back. I mean, bone chip, one little tiny bone chip in her knee, you know, it got removed really quickly and easily, and she'll need some box rest, and then obviously she'll need some paddock rest and whatnot, but she'll be back. But yeah, this great game, it is the great game, isn't it? It's incredibly frustrating at times, but we all seem to come back to it time and time again.
That's it, the highs and lows. Well, fingers crossed that she recovers fully and we can see her back winning again. So you're an ambassador for My Racehorse. Is getting people interested in racing and ownership something that you're really passionate about?
Yeah, I'm really passionate about this business. It started in America a few years ago and then has come to Australia in the last few years. And the team in America, they've had an incredible success over there with the horses that they've raced. And I think it was only in year two or three here where Just Fine won the Metropolitan. So a group one in their first couple of years. They have decent size numbers. It's not like they've got 100 horses on the books, but they've got, you know, decent size numbers and great people giving terrific advice as to which yearlings to buy, which tried horses to buy, which imports to buy. But the reason I'm passionate about the business is that it does let the everyman and the everywoman be involved in racing. It's not just about the millionaires, the billionaires, and those who have been involved with the game for generation upon generation, but it allows anybody who has sat at the pub on a Saturday and had a couple of bets and gone, I'd love to do that, but I just don't have the means to do it. It allows them to do it in a way that's economical. They get the full experience of owning a horse, whether that be, you know, getting your voice reports on a Wednesday, getting to the races and getting into the mounting out on a Saturday. It's not necessarily a money-making exercise because you're owning such a small share in a horse, but you get to come along for the ride and race with the best trainers across the country, and you've got the best hoops riding your horses, often on Saturdays, often at city meetings and in group ones. So we recently, down in Melbourne, we had Just Fine running in the Melbourne Cup. Obviously, I think we all know he probably doesn't stay the 3,200 metres. It was a tough lesson to learn. But the night before, on the Monday, we had an event at a pub in Melbourne where we had like 900 owners from My Racehorse come along. And we had Adrian Bott there. We had Damon Gabbity, who's our bloodstock manager there. We all got up and we, you know, did a couple of Q&As. And you could have heard a pin drop throughout every single one of those chats. Tilly McCarroll, the horse's strapper, was there. People were just got a thirst to learn about this game and a thirst to come along for the ride. It was exceptional, and we'll do more of those events in time. Yeah, it's a really great concept, and they've obviously expanded into stallion ownership recently as well, with owning a share in Hitotsu. That's given people a great thrill to see his first foals land on the ground as well. At Arrowfield, so that's been a cool partnership to be involved with. But yeah, I'm really passionate about not just making racing for the elite, so to speak. Anyone can be involved with it. I mean, everyone is involved with it day to day. When you're having a bet, like, turnover and wagering will tell you that it's not just the top dogs in town having a bet. Everyone who loves racing is having a bet, responsibly, of course. But to let people come along for the ride, with owning, yeah, whether it be a yearling, a two-year-old, a tried horse, it's really exciting. And I see it every single day when I'm on track and I see those My Racehorse owners. They absolutely love it. And I love people who have passion for what they are interested in. Like, they have passion for it. If you don't love it, don't do it. So, yeah, I'm very passionate about that as a concept.
Spot on. It's funny, on our last episode, we had Terry Henderson from OTI Racing on, and he was talking up My Racehorse and the great things it does. It doesn't matter whether you own a hair on the tail or whether it's you own the whole horse. You still own the horse, and it's all a bit of fun at the end of the day. So it's a great thing that My Racehorse does. But one thing I do want to touch on there is you mentioned Hitotsu and My Racehorse being involved there. How's the uptake been around that? And I guess what have the customers said as well?
Pretty sure it's sold out in... it did take a little bit of time because it's a new product out in the market. You know, owning a stallion, people be confused by that, but pretty sure it sold out. And along with your share, so to speak, in Hitotsu, you got a share in the mares. I think it was five or six mares, and then their progeny. And then the real test will be when they head to the sales, like, how exciting. So I guess I am a broodmare owner in a way, Justin, with My Racehorse, but it gets people to follow another side of the industry. Okay, so how many mares does a stallion cover each season? Okay, so these are the mares we want to pair with Hitotsu. These are the mares who are best suited with their due to their page or due to their physicality or whatever it is. Why are they best suited? Okay, we've got these mares. They're best suited to him. Okay, now we've got a couple of fillies and a couple of colts. All right, now we raise them and we let them graze on these beautiful paddocks at Arrowfield. We let them be with mum. They grow up to be these yearlings, and then all of the sales reps, whether it be from Inglis or Magic Millions, come and inspect them. Okay, where are they best suited to? Which sale should we take them to? So there's so many different parts to it that people are allowed to come along for the journey. So the uptake was really good. I think initially, I don't want to give the first day we launched it on Seven. I know and we did launch it on the Seven broadcast. Perfect. Like, they're our viewers, and they're those who would want to be involved with that product. The figures day one were off the charts. Off the charts good. So it's something I think they'll look at again. The team are really, they're savvy. They're looking at other bits and pieces to get people involved with the different aspects of the industry all the time. I know there's chat at the moment about maybe doing something overseas next year, a little tour. I know there's a couple of there's, I don't want to say too much, but there's a couple of international horses that they're looking at the moment into buying into that would be, geez, it'd be big. It'd be big. So yeah, they're always looking at exciting opportunities to allow people to come along for the ride, I guess.
Oh, that's exciting. It's big opportunities coming up for both potential owners out there and, of course, my racehorse as well. It's is a great thing that they're doing for racing and ownership in general. But I want to wind the clock back just one last time here before we get to our last segment. And we were talking to one of the great people in the industry, Adam Sangster, and this was at Caulfield. And we mentioned that you were coming on the podcast this week, and he said to bring up a story about his father, Robert, being at the Flemington Stables one day.
Yeah,
As he said, young Emma would bring around a caddy of drinks to everyone. They must be some fond memories, and to obviously still spoken about today.
Yeah. Oh gosh, what a wonderful family. And this is, you know, it was obviously a wonderful childhood to be able to meet and really connect with so many people in the industry, whether it be the Sangsters, whether it be the Mitchells from Yarraman, who are still very good friends of the family, the Ortons from Vinery. Geez, it goes on and on and on and on. Even, you know, as I was saying, Katie, who's one of my best friends, like his beautiful mum, Mary, and my mum about the same age, like not too long ago, Mary said, oh, you know, you used to sit in the paddling pool with Andrew, you know, and that's how long back all these connections go. Like Nick Hall was always around in my childhood as well, you know, Greg Hall and Ollie, and I was at, remember being a young girl at Ollie's wedding. Like, they're obviously very privileged times, but people who I have great respect for. Yes, the drinks caddy. So I would walk around, I was very young, maybe like 4 or 5, and give the beers, which you couldn't do nowadays, but back in the 80s and the early 90s you could, giving out drinks. And I think the story goes as well, it was after a Melbourne Cup. It might have been either 89 or 92. I want to say it was 92 because it would make more sense. Otherwise, I would have been a child prodigy if it was 89. But I think I was handing the beers and the drinks out. But also, I pulled out a boombox, and I had a cassette tape in it. And I quite like dancing, and I still do. And everyone was sitting outside. I think some of the illustrious names who were sitting outside included surnames like Packer and Sangster. And I decided to do a concert, and I pushed the button on the boombox and started to dance, and everyone wasn't interested, to the point where apparently I stopped it and yelled at everybody to watch me. And I danced for everyone, and apparently I got the full attention of those with the surname Packer and Sangster, as they were giggling under their breath at this four-year-old who was obviously had a pretty decent opinion of her own dancing skills back then. So yeah, I'm sure we've caught up a few times in the last few years, and that story's always always brought up, that I was a born performer. I mean, it mortifies me slightly now to think that I did that. These are very important clients of my family, and I was treating them like my ticket holders for my show. I don't know how it ended. It must have ended with mum going, okay, bed now, let's go to bed. But I put on a real show, and look, 34 or 5 years later, and they're still talking about it.
Oh, that is fantastic. We will finish off, Emma, today with our fast five. It's just five quick fire questions, just answer off the top of your head. So we'll get stuck into it. First one, what is your favourite memory on a racetrack?
Favourite memory on a racetrack, Mackaybe Diva's third Melbourne Cup, obviously, is up there along with her Cox Plate. In recent times, though, it's been any day that I've been at the Everest, if I'm being honest. I just love that day. I love the energy. I love the enthusiasm of the crowd. I love the concept of the race. And I love the emotion that the participants display when they're in it and when they win it.
Do you have an embarrassing moment or a funny moment or a little blooper that you can think of from TV where you sit back and go, oh,
well, Justin, I think we've just done the embarrassing moment. not that I can really remember. We all have them every now and then when you might get confused and you call a Mary Gelding or something like that. But yeah, though nothing to the point where I've been absolutely mortified by, but it will come. It will come.
Hopefully not this weekend. A night out with the family, what is the cuisine of choice?
Ooh, Italian.
Now, this might be a tricky one, but Todd McKenney or Helen Ritchie?
Oh, Helen. Oh, Helen. Absolutely, Helen. Just darling. She's still up. Though Todd is he's a shark. He's great, very good at what he does. But, she is literally the queen of the ballroom, Helen Ritchie.
And hypothetically speaking, as an owner of Philly, would you rather win the Everest or the Melbourne Cup?
The Everest, for sure. In terms of residual value, I think that carries a lot more weight. I think we'll all agree about that. If you've got a mare who gets over 3,200 metres and she wins a Group 1 like the Melbourne Cup, obviously she's going to be worth a huge amount. But where we're placed at the moment with a big focus on two-year-olds and speed, if you had a mare like Bella Nipotina, who won the Everest, my goodness, you'd be well placed for the future.
Emma, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you and going back through some amazing memories and experiences that you've had. Obviously, stoked that Taylor's been able to join as well, with you having been one of her idols. And yeah, we just thank you very much for coming on and taking the time out of your day.
Taylor, you'll spend time with me and you'll be like, she's just a... She's mad. All the good ones are, though. All the good ones are. Thank you, guys. I appreciate that. And, yeah, loving what you're doing. Have listened to the podcast a number of times. Listened to your one with John Stewart recently, and I really enjoyed that. He's a very interesting character, isn't he? So good job doing these because, the stories behind racing are very important.
Thanks a million, Emma.